Can I help you?
I told her that I was looking for Natalie. Natalie Morales.
She said her name is something else. Duran?
It used to be that. Is she here? The woman unlatched the chain. She stepped out of the house with a flood of warmth.
Natalie's in the back. She and Ron rent my guest house.
She directed me to a sandstone path where small lamps illuminated the way.
How nice she has visitors, she said with disdain.
Manny and Natalie were in the backyard between the two houses, shouting in clipped tones above the dark grass. Tommy sat in a plastic chair on the guesthouse stoop, a gangly white guy beside him, watching over the altercation like some shitty owl. Ronald, I thought. What a catch. When Tommy saw me, he removed his glasses, setting them in his lap. Natalie sharked around, her long hair lightened to a caramel color, waved across the yard. She stood before me, looking small and silly with her blondish hair. She'd lost weight, too, like she wore her skeleton over her skin.
Her! Natalie screamed at Manny, pointing in my direction. You let some ex-con watch Tommy!
She turned to me then, her eyes glinting with rage.
You're a worthless piece of shit, Nicole. Do not take my son anywhere again.
I started laughing.
Where would I take him? To visit you?
Behind us, the lights of the big house flipped on, and there were sounds like someone stumbling down a staircase. Ronald sipped a beer covered in a koozie.
Babe, let's be more respectful to Shauna, he said.
I gazed at Natalie.
You left to live here with your ugly-ass boyfriend who smells like a ferret?
Natalie reached up and popped me in the mouth. Blood spurted from my bottom lip. I wiped the red on my hands, searching for somewhere to spit the iron taste. I saw her herb garden, planted neatly beneath sheer umbrellas. I walked over, kicked aside the plastic cover, and coughed blood all over her dead rosemary.
You hit her!
I heard Tommy shout. I looked at him and saw how scared and sad and small he was. His glasses were back on his face, magnifying his brown eyes. In his lap, he roped his hands over his tummy. I immediately felt worse for being there. What kind of people were we? Tommy had watched his aunt fight his mother in the yard of a guest house she shared with some idiot who owned a koozie. His father was standing by, mortified, face to face with his wife's new white boyfriend.
If you touch me, Natalie screamed, I'll call the police and you'll be back where you belong. We're leaving, Manny said, marching over and gripping Tommy's forearm.
As we headed for the pickup, Manny turned back and asked, politely as possible, for the pillows. Natalie ignored him and slammed shut the guesthouse door. I felt sorry for her then. I knew she was embarrassed by herself and had been her whole life. She'd always feel like that brown girl from the north side with a baby at 17, living in her husband's decrepit house. I thought of something my father used to say in Spanish. You cannot straighten the trunk of a crooked tree. At home, Tommy ran to his bedroom, while Manny went into the kitchen and filled a glass of water. He handed it to me and sat at the table, motioning for me to do the same.
What happened? I asked.
He just walked over there, Manny said. He misses his mom, I guess.
Was he scared? Did he get lost?
He's fine. But you can't do something like that again. You need to watch him better.
I told him that it was an accident, that Tomi took off on his own. But the more I spoke, the more painfully familiar my voice sounded, like a recording of myself from years ago. I paused, listening to the house sounds instead. The refrigerator buzzed. The floorboards creaked. It was like our home was an old man with a damp cough. I think there's something wrong with me, I said.
Your reflexes could use some help. Duck next time.
No, like, as a person. I couldn't hold back from crying. Tears flowed down my nose, salting my split lip. I always screw up. I always hurt my family.
Manny looked around, searching for napkins, finding none. With quick fingers, he unbuttoned his flannel, placing it in my hands.
Wipe off your face. There's nothing wrong with you. And there never was.
He stood from his seat, starting up the stairs with an arched back, looking oddly thin in his white undershirt.
Tomorrow, I'm going to help you look for jobs. We'll start early. Make sure you're awake.
Manny quieted his voice.
I'm sorry that I didn't visit you, Cole.
Thank you, brother.
You're a lot better than you used to be. A lot better.
After he went upstairs to bed, the house was silent. I stayed at the table for a long while, thinking about many things, my mother and father, my brother and myself as children, how black Manny's hair had once been, how little our home had changed. The ancient oak floors, the strange dusty quality to the air, the flutter of green curtains and the softness of night. This home was all we ever had. After several minutes, I went to the basement, where I crawled onto my futon and quietly, with my face to my jacket, cried again. Not long after, someone opened the basement door. They walked quickly without switching on the lights, and I knew that it was Tomi. He sat on the edge of the futon near my feet. He said nothing, and I didn't need him to. It was a sensation I used to get as a child, the feeling of someone you love resting at the foot of your bed, after they've told you a story when there's nothing left to say. I listened to Tomi breathe, small-lunged, stuffy-nosed. He built up air a few times like he wanted to say something, but remained quiet. Then I felt his weight gradually leave the futon. But before heading upstairs, Tomi came back and set something beside my face. I squinted through the darkness. A pillow.
You've had them the whole time? I asked.
Tomi paused on the stairs. He looked over his shoulder, his glasses catching what little light was between us.
Why?
He asked.
Do you need another one?
Any Further West. Read for you by Marisol Ramirez. I grew up in an adobe home with my mother and grandmother in Sahuarita, Colorado. It was only us girls. There had never been any men. My mother used to say that her father died at the hands of a madman over a gold watch. But once my grandmother told me that the only hands that killed him were his own. As for my father, he took my mother on one date to a drive-in theater on Alonzo Lane. And you, my baby, my grandmother would say years later, are the reason nice girls don't sit in cars with boys. She was a small, shadowy woman, my grandmother. She kept an herb garden in the backyard, hung her laundry on metal cords, and occasionally snapped the necks of chickens with an elegant flick of the wrist. Every morning of her life, she woke up exhausted. I'm too damn old to still be raising children, she'd say. And I don't mean you, Neva. She was talking about my mother, Desiree Leticia Cordova. Throughout her life, she had struggled with booze and dope and all those good-for-nothing men. In her 20s, she danced in a strip club on the edge of town called Wishes. In her 30s, the small portion of them she got to live, she uprooted us to California during one of her ecstatic breaks from perpetual sadness. These breaks were infrequent but potent and gave my mother the strength of 10 women who require no sleep and live for their whims. I was 12 when my mother called me into her bedroom one evening before work. She stumbled around in search of a gold bikini, the radio on a doo-wop station, the air reeking of her curling iron. After pulling the bikini from a mound of wrinkled clothes on the floor, she lifted her tank top and applied makeup over her Caesarean scar. The red slash eased away, and she peered at herself in the vanity's dust-speckled mirror. This town is a real dump, she said. It doesn't offer us enough opportunities. I'm making some big plans. I'm thinking San Diego with all that sunshine. We left 2 months later. My mother convinced a white-haired cowboy who worked in oil and gas to give her a couple $1,000s. She claimed the money meant nothing to him because he had more of it than God. My grandmother told me that was bullshit. There are chains attached to cash, she said. I pictured mustached men in Stetson hats rattling their linked steel arms. I didn't want to leave home, but I knew if I stayed with my grandmother in Sahuarita, my mother would have no one but those chains. The day we left, I loaded the car as my mother handed me luggage and supplies, cookbooks, rain jackets, batteries, potato chips. Through the haze of early morning, I saw our home anchored to the earth, a short slant above sage grass, seated before the sapphire mountains. As the sun broke completely over the land, my grandmother stepped outside in a quilted apron and pink house shoes. She held a cup of tea, the waves of steam stopping just short of her jaw. She squinted at us. It's going to rain along the way. You pull off if it pours. Of course I know that, Mama, said my mother. My grandmother glanced at me. Take care of her. And for Christ's sake, Desiree, take care of yourself. Eula Court curved like a shark's fin from one green gully filled with trash to another. Rows of rainbow-colored houses flickered by until my mother parked the car outside a boxy home, sunshine yellow with white trim. She checked her reflection in the rearview mirror, blotting her wide forehead and deep cleavage with a napkin. She applied sparkly lip gloss. She adjusted her spaghetti straps. This, I said, pointing with my index finger, is where we're going to live? We're number 2, she said. The place in back, a carriage house. I followed my mother to the main house, where she rang the doorbell and gently knocked. From behind her, I could make out her shoulder bones, ridged, as if her skeleton had been shattered and glued hastily back together. When the door opened and we were ushered inside by a man's high-pitched voice, my mother's back disappeared, swallowed by indoor dimness. There was only a black leather sofa and a television in the front room. A youngish man in flip-flops and a puka shell necklace stood before us with sloppy brown hair, done in the style girls at my old school called the lazy freshness. He introduced himself as Casey, the landlord.
Hope the drive was easy for you, ladies, he said, his chin tilted upward. You're sure gonna love this place.
Casey helped us unload the car. He moved with uncoordinated enthusiasm. The carriage house, he explained, was a lot like his house, only miniature. After pointing out the gas stove, the water heater, and the vibration we might feel when the garage door beneath us either opened or closed, he patted the pockets on his cargo shorts and produced two sets of keys.
"Don't lose them. I'll have to charge you $1,000,000.
My mother laughed and swiped his shoulder. "Must have the toughest locks in all of California on these doors."
"Yep, but I keep mine open for the most part."
When he asked if we needed anything else, my mother said everything was fine and thanked him. She watched as he returned to the front house. Between the homes was a small grassy courtyard, his shadowed back windows facing our sunny front ones. "I like him," my mother said after some time. "Seems dependable." The carriage house was nothing like our home in Sahuarita. Palm trees and hibiscus budded against the front door, which opened to a small elevated stoop where cement steps and a white iron handrail led the way into Casey's courtyard. The stove, the counters, and the tiles were avocado green. My bedroom was a tiny eggshell space, while my mother's was large and airy, with her queen-size bed dead center beneath the ceiling fan. Her lacy thrift store dresses hung in the closet, and her plastic jewelry was looped over thumbtacks in the walls. Her perfumes, vanillas and spices, florals and orientals, were displayed atop her vanity. The windows were always open, allowing in stark sunlight and city smells, distant sea salt, car exhaust, In-N-Out burger. "Ah, for the love of God," my grandmother would tell me over the phone. "What a phony paradise." Soon it was clear my mother needed a job. There was only enough cash to cover the cost of moving and the first couple months' rent. Because my grandmother wasn't there to stay with me at night, my mother gave up dancing. "No matter," she claimed. She was ready for change. Most days before and after school, I'd find her in our kitchen, furiously circling job listings in the paper. She'd stand at the counter, a pen in hand and one leg kicked up behind her like a flamingo. "I think I could do this," she'd say, pointing to an ad for a secret shopper or a dog walker. "I saw commercials on TV, advertising dental assistant school and massage therapy classes. When I suggested she do something like that, my mother always laughed. We don't have the money for school, Hita. Plus, I'm not one for studying." Though the prospect of her landing a decent, well-paying job seemed far-fetched, she never let on that we should worry about rent or food. Not even birthday cake. That November, I turned 13. "You're my everything, mi vida," my mother said as she pushed a cart through the grocery store. She wore a large shoulder purse and dirty platform sandals. Her black liner was smudged around her eyes, and I worried she had been crying. That morning, she gave me a shoebox. Inside was a sheet of white paper on which she had written, "Once I get a job, this will be whatever you want. Love, Mama." I carried the note in my pocket as the cart rattled and whined throughout the aisles. 60s pop music played from the ceiling speakers. My mother's hips swayed to the sounds, only pausing when she held up various items. Milano cookies, ice cream bars, tres leches cake. "Any of these?" she asked. Beside us, a white woman in shiny sandals glared in our direction. I lowered my voice. "We don't have the money, Mama." "Come on, Neva, whatever you want, it's your day." She waved a box of Nutter Butters in my face. "These are your favorite." I shook my head. "But we can't." My mother kissed my forehead, leaving the waxy feeling of her peach lipstick. I turned away while she threw the cookies into the cart. She went through the aisles, tossing in more items, cupcakes, scented candles, avocados, olives, maraschino cherries. After some time, my mother pushed the cart behind a pyramid of canned soda. She unzipped her purse, and it swallowed everything as though it were a bottomless, hungry mouth. When she was done, the only items in the cart were the Nutter Butters and a jar of mayonnaise. My mother smacked her gum as the clerk rang her up for $7.34. From her bra, she handed over a limp $10 bill. I looked to the floor at my jelly sandals, at the grime in the grooves of the polished cement, at my mother's pristine blue toenail polish. Then I saw flip-flops. Casey stood behind us with a basket of hummus and eggs.
"Must be a party tonight,"
he said, eyeing our cookies and mayonnaise. My mother turned, brightened her eyes with a smile.
"It is a party. Neva's turning 13 today. We're going to Balboa Park to celebrate."
"Welcome to your teen years, chica."
Casey held his fingers above different chocolates along the register, said he was feeling them for vibes. He tossed a packet of M&Ms onto the black conveyor belt, along with his hummus and eggs.
"Happy birthday, kid. Hope you like the kind with peanuts."
"I'm allergic," I lied. My mother bumped me with her purse.
"If you're not busy, why don't you join us?"
On the eastern edge of Balboa Park, the three of us sat on a Mexican blanket in the grass near a pond of koi fish. My mother set out the stolen food, and if Casey knew we didn't pay, he said nothing. He lay there with his arms folded beneath his neck, his green eyes cloudy and his smile slightly crooked with his chemically whitened teeth. With my mother nestled beside him, he spoke of surfing accidents, killer earthquakes, and all-night beach bonfires. My mother told him she loved the ocean, and that as a little girl she dreamed of its deep and bright creatures. As the sun lowered in the sky, a warm breeze tugged at the pond's surface, and the two of them sang happy birthday to me. I blew out a stolen candle, stuffed into a stolen cupcake, and worried the entire time that strangers might mistake us for a family. Casey didn't work. He could barely fix our drains when they clogged with ropes of black hair. Mostly, he collected rent checks from the different properties his parents had given him down by the border and further inland in those neighborhoods I never saw. Each morning, he cut through the horror movie fog of the city, running alongside the shores of the Pacific. When he returned, he would shower and then knock on our door, where he flirted with my mother, leaning against our doorframe, the sky behind him blisteringly white. By mid-October, he cut us a deal on rent, and by November, there was no rent to pay at all. Thanksgiving, a time when the mountains of Sahuarita were bleached with snowfall, our yard in California was an eruption of fuchsia flowers and maize-like palms. I was relieved that school was out for break, though I was friendly with a few girls who read Teen Beat and YM magazines during lunch. I kept mostly to myself. Perhaps that's why my teacher always called me Natalie or Maria, anything but my name. When I told my grandmother about this over the phone, she groaned with irritation.
"And has your mama found a job yet?"
I didn't tell her that my mother wasn't looking for work anymore, that she wasn't doing much besides spending time with Casey. It was early December when I walked home from school one Friday afternoon and heard them arguing in the front house. The windows were open and the sounds of classic rock and my mother's cries spilled into the street.
"You promised us a deal," she kept saying. "I have to go back to dancing."
A group of boys from my middle school walked home across the block toward one of the trash-filled gullies. Two boys giggled, patting the others on the shoulders, pointing for them to listen. I tossed my backpack on the sidewalk.
"Hey, morons!" I shouted. "Mind your own business!"
The boys turned to look at me. They blinked, scrunched their faces. One of them mouthed, "What the?" He held up his right hand, displaying an orange Game Boy as bright as a flare. They weren't listening to my mother and Casey. They were trying to beat a high score. With my cheeks burning red, I looped around the block 3 times before I went home. When I got back, Casey stepped onto his porch in sunglasses, a beach towel slung over his arm. My mother appeared behind him in the darkness of the house, her arm slithering down his chest. "Do you want to go to Mission Beach with us?" she asked. "There's a roller coaster there." They were both obviously drunk or stoned, maybe both. My mother asked again if I'd go. She walked outside and kneeled down to me. She ran her long fingernails along my neck, sending warmth down my spine. "Please come," she said. "I'll get you a kite. Everyone loves a kite." At Mission Beach, Casey bought me a funnel cake and gave me quarters to play old-timey arcade games. We went out on the pier, and my mother got a kite with a plastic handle. She started it in the wind before handing it to me. It shifted up and dropped before it got caught beneath the pier. I left it dangling in the surf. On the boardwalk, we waited in line for the roller coaster. Casey slipped his hand in my mother's back pocket. She giggled and leaned into him. We rode the roller coaster before the sunset. I sat behind them, marveling at the way they both jerked a little too much and a little too late as the coaster curved. That Sunday, my mother slept until the evening. While she was in bed, I read a mystery paperback on the living room floor. Children were science experiments gone wrong. They had broken wings and X-ray vision. Their parents were mad researchers. I finished the book just before the room faded from dusk to night in several slow minutes. I tried waking up my mother then, first by shaking her, and then with something to eat. On the gas stove, I warmed flour tortillas, covered them with butter and sugar, and brought them to her side. She let out a few wet snores, turning herself over and away from me. I ate the tortillas myself before crawling beside her. When she woke up later, I asked what was wrong. "Everything stays the same," she said. "Nothing changes. It makes me feel like I'm dead." "You're just sad today, Mama. You'll feel better tomorrow." I hugged her, and after a long silence, I said, "Tell me a story." "About what, Neva? You know all my stories." "How about me? What was it like when I was born?" My mother moaned and adjusted herself. I reached for her hand, weaving her slender fingers, limp as lace, into mine. "It was snowing. I was so tired, and Grandma was so tired. They cut you out of me because you wouldn't come for hours." She took our hands, moving them beneath the blankets and sheets, halting at her Caesarean scar. "Here. This is where you came from. You cried and cried. The doctor said you cried so much you'd never need to cry again. They were right. You never cry, Neva. You're always tough." She paused a moment, and we were both quiet. "Now you," she said in a tone of rising hopefulness. "You tell me a story." I had no idea what to say. All my stories were her stories. I considered the things I knew that I wanted her to know, too. Like how much I hated California. How little I knew or liked Casey. But instead, I told her this. "Did you know the palm trees in our yard and all over this neighborhood, they aren't from San Diego? They aren't even from California. We learned about it in school. They don't belong here. Someone just thought they looked pretty." "No," my mother said. "I didn't know that." She then stopped talking and fell asleep. I would have stayed there with her forever if not for the knock on our door an hour later when Casey stopped by, inviting us to dinner. When I told my grandmother about my mother's new boyfriend and her staying in bed until nighttime, she wanted us home immediately. She called my mother every day to talk sense into her. It wasn't good for me, she claimed. I needed structure and family. She said my mother should attend Mass regularly, visit confession. When my mother stopped taking her calls, my grandmother sent letters addressed to Desiree Leticia in elegant, shaky script. Though she didn't have the money for a flight, and she was too old to drive any further west, my grandmother made sure we felt her presence. In one of her letters, she begged my mother to remember her father. "He let the world beat him down, break him," she wrote. "He allowed the world to fill up on his sadness." A week before Christmas, Casey and my mother ate sunflower seeds and passed a bottle of whiskey between them on the beach. They took long swallows, wilting into one another, sloppy and euphoric. We were near the pier, the underside of its wooden belly bleached. Surfers in bodysuits ran beneath the stilts, their boards in hand. Faded blue tattoos winked across the backs of old men with salty hair. The ocean's howl was wild.
"Neva," Casey said. "It means snow, right? In Latin or something?"
I shrugged, slipping my hand beneath the cool sand.
"Sure does," said my mother. "Her grandma picked it out. It was blizzarding when Neva was born. If we lived here, maybe we would have named her Sunshine or Sunny."
My mother giggled, a seed flying from her mouth.
"I like it," Casey said. "It's different. You like the beach, Neva?"
I told him the beach was all right.
"That's not true," my mother blurted out. "You love the beach," she turned to Casey. "The first time we came here, I couldn't pry her away from the water. She kept splashing and screaming when the waves hit her little toes."
Casey laughed.
"How about for Christmas Eve, we drive up the coast? There's a beachfront motel in Solana. A buddy of mine can get us a deal on a boat. I figure since you have no family here and my folks are in Florida, we could go together."
My mother fell into him, landing a kiss mostly on his mouth.
"Sounds perfect, baby."
Casey nudged me with his shoulder.
"Come on, chica. It's my treat."
I rose from our beach blanket and headed toward the water.
"Be careful," I heard my mother shout. "It'll be freezing."
There was no line between ocean and sky. White gulls appeared black in the clouds' shadows. I unzipped my jacket and rolled my jeans to my knees. Though the sand was uneven and fine and the water dim, I walked ahead until my legs were soaked. It only burned a moment before my skin went numb. In school, we learned the entire Southwest desert was once underwater. Everywhere was a shallow sea. My mother sometimes told me she felt like she was drowning. She had dreams of waking up dead, dreams of sleeping forever. "But what about me?" I asked more than once, and she always said I was lucky. Lucky because I knew how to swim. As I moved through the waves, my mother and Casey were still on the shore, their legs entangled like four pale links in the same gait. One of the surfers bobbed past me, shouting for me to head back. At the beach blanket, I stood above my mother and Casey. The sun had come out, my shadow long over their faces.
"You were right, Mama," I said. "It's freezing out there."
"It will be a great Christmas," my mother said as she packed four bags for our one-night stay in Solana Beach. "Probably the best Christmas we've ever had." She stood at her closet, selecting summer dresses for the dead of winter. Wedge heels, corked sandals, and floppy sun hats. I lay across her bedspread, wondering at the way her back disappeared into darkness as she pushed forward into her clothes. She turned around with an armful of bathing suits. She asked me to choose one. I pointed to a bikini with red polka dots. My mother changed before me, sliding her panties down her legs beneath her t-shirt. She pulled on the suit bottoms, secured the top strings, and sheepishly turned to face me, her left arm over her stomach. "This one?" she asked. "It doesn't make me look fat?" "Of course not, Mama." Though her figure was tight and trim, a holdover from her years as a dancer, in nature there were no forgiving club lights. There was only the sun and its unrelenting shine. My mother reminded me of this as she twirled, all black hair and swinging arms. "What about my scar?" "I've seen it 1,000 times. But Casey hasn't. I never let him see it in the light." "Who cares?" I suggested. My mother had me pick another bathing suit. In the end, she went with a one-piece, all white with scooped-out hips. She then disappeared once more into her closet. She reemerged with a small wooden box. She set it before me, urging me to open it. I unlatched the brass clasp delicately, but my mother laughed, taking my hands in hers. "No need to be gentle, baby. It's not the box that's special." Inside was a charm bracelet with only 3 charms, a baby rattle, a chicken, a locket. My mother spun the bracelet around my wrist, stopping at the locket. "When you were 2, you came down with this bad fever," she said. "You are so hot that I could barely touch you." My mother opened the locket, revealing 2 tufts of dark hair. "Grandma said you'd die if we didn't bring it down. I gave you cold baths. You didn't cry at all. You just sat in the tub shivering. I prayed all night and in the morning, just like that, you were better. Calm and smiling and the right temperature. So you know what I did?" "No," I said. "I can't remember." My mother kissed my head. "I cut off a piece of your hair. Fever hair, I called it. I put it in this locket with a piece of my own hair. I don't know why, but it makes me happy to have us together like that." I felt the weight of the bracelet on my wrist. I thought of how strange it would be to touch someone so hot with fever you could barely hold them. I had never felt someone like that, and I wondered if I ever would. That night, TV static like snow played in my mind as I moved between sleeplessness and dreams. I imagined laughter, the kind you hear walking alongside playgrounds with small children making use of every object, a stick to the fence, a foot to the ear, their telephone call home. I saw lush flowers, lemon and orange trees, and volcanic rock gardens that were beautiful instead of strange to me at Christmas time. I pictured Casey driving us to Solana Beach, whizzing past lurching shorelines and multi-million-dollar glass houses. I felt the salty mist of La Jolla's cliffs and heard the enormous barking seals. I thought of my mother. I thought of napping beside her in a large motel bed beneath windows open to the sea. But Casey didn't come for us. And while I wasn't surprised, my mother went through stages of disbelief. She sat very still in our kitchen, drinking what little vodka she found in the freezer. Maybe he was sick. Maybe there was an accident. Maybe he needed help. She smoked a pack of Marlboro Lights without bothering to open the windows. A single line emerged between her eyebrows, difficult to read beneath the resting smoke. When she eventually realized he wasn't coming, she called him every name in the book, chaining together the insults like an endless train of cocksuckers and motherfuckers and assholes. "He's a bad guy," she said firmly with her final cigarette between 2 fingers, resting against her temple. "Just another piece of shit." I tried to stop her as she barreled down the cement steps, heading toward the front house. She was going to destroy something. Herself or otherwise. I watched in awe as she slipped into rage as easily as she had slipped into her bathing suit. She pounded with her fists on his windows and tossed rocks at his mailbox. She threw mud across his door. When she finished, her fingernails broken and lined with dirt, there wasn't much to do but sit on the stoop and watch as one by one Christmas lights flickered along our block. After some time, my mother began to cry. Quietly at first, until she heaved uncontrollably, her back to me, her shoulder blades quivering in their jagged way. I kneeled down to her, holding her face to mine with both hands. We were matted together in her tears.
"Will you nap with me, baby?"
she asked. I told her yes. I pulled her from the stoop. She lay beside me in bed. It was warm, though the windows were open and the ceiling fan was on high. I pushed the bedspread onto the floor when my mother's back grew sticky with sweat. Her eyelids squeezed, her lashes fluttered. "I think we're done here, Neva. I think it's best we go home." At 4 in the morning, a deep vibration shook the bed. It was the garage door opening. Casey was back. My mother woke up, making a sound like she was catching her breath. She ran to him in the courtyard. I watched them argue through the front windows. Something about a flat tire, a friend's flat tire, difficult properties down on the border. My mother's hair flew around her face, covering her eyes. Her nightgown was transparent, and she was naked beneath a thin fabric. As she spoke to Casey, my mother covered her belly, hiding her midsection scar. That's when I went back to bed and listened to their fighting until my mother came inside just before sunrise. She grabbed face wash from our bathroom and stood in my doorframe. We looked at one another. "Don't worry," she said breathless. "I'm not upset anymore." She turned and stepped into the hallway, locking the door of the carriage house before she left for Casey's. On Christmas morning, I woke up from a dream of snow. When we lived in Sewarita, I would have run to the living room to hug my mother, kiss my grandmother, and open my stocking filled with practical gifts, the kind no one wants but everyone needs. Socks, underwear, floss, chapstick. I walked through my mother's bedroom and opened her closet. My face was against her things. Cheek to sleeve, lips to collar, nose to cotton. I fell into her jackets and blouses, dresses and skirts. I breathed in, smelling 1,000 different spices, all of them sweet. Outside, the fog had rolled in, low to the earth, seeping into the asphalt and grass. I found my mother loading the car, hunched down in a long white dress and straw hat, 2 braids falling around her shoulders. She waved to me as I stepped barefoot over the cement path from Casey's house to the street. The sky was all clouds, with a single prominent streak, an airplane's tail sailing east. My mother slammed the trunk before turning to me on the sidewalk. Her eyes were large black pools. Her face was dewy and young, just as it was the day we arrived in California. "Hurry now," she said. "Grab your bags." "Where are we going?" I asked. "Home?" My mother clicked her tongue, stifling a laugh. "We're going to the beach with Casey, remember?" I looked at her face for a long while, hoping to catch a hint of sarcasm, an eyebrow raised, an upper lip curled. But my mother only smiled with faintly blue lips, moving her fingers through the air, edging me on with beautiful wide nails. Behind me, Casey walked outside in sunglasses, briefly lifting them from his face as he pulled my mother in for a kiss. With closed eyes, they knocked against the car door. My mother's hat flew from her head, exposing her wide forehead before swirling into the sky and landing swiftly at my toes. I picked up the hat, bringing it to my mother, who took it gently from my hands, the noble arcs of her thumbs mirroring my own. The air went still between us as I grazed her skin, so cool and strange, nearly dead. Casey asked, "You don't feel well, Chica?" I told him I was fine. "Then hurry," said my mother. Her stance was wobbly and unrefined, as though she had given someone else permission to wear her skin. That's when I knew she was forever caught in her own undercurrent, bouncing from one deep swell to the next. She would never lift me out of that sea. She would never pause to fill her lungs with air. Soon the world would yank her chain of sadness against every shore, every rock, every glass-filled beach, leaving nothing but the broken hull of a drowned woman. I turned away from my mother then, heading toward the carriage house, whispering no so many times that I sounded like a cooing dove. My mother asked more than once for me to stop. The further I walked, the further her voice moved from giddy to shrill, rising above the hibiscus and palm trees, booming off the front house and carriage house doors.
All Her Names. Read for you by Alma Cuervo. Michael was aging. His smile was young, but the slack of his skin and the hollows of his face belonged to someone much older than 33. He was a sales manager at a medium-sized marijuana dispensary on Colfax Avenue that resembled a cell phone store, complete with kiosks of edibles and cases of hardware. Whenever Alicia's husband Gary left town for his annual auctioneer's convention, she called Michael. She recognized her inability to spend an evening alone, that, and she still loved Michael. Probably always would. When night fell, Alicia slipped into his old teal Nova, a vision out of a lowrider magazine, even if the interior was a pigsty. She could see a crumpled sweatshirt, some woman's black tights, and three empty spray paint cans on the floor. Alicia picked up one of the cans. It rattled like pebbles as she rolled it across Michael's lap. "Keep this shit in the trunk. Joaquin got charged with a felony last summer." "Only because that pendejo couldn't outrun the bull. Besides, someone has to make these invasive yuppies uncomfortable. Weedy motherfuckers, growing out of control." In his worn leather jacket, Michael gestured toward Gary and Alicia's concrete and glass house, a black square among the updated Victorians. "Where to, my little gentrification Malinche?" "Lawrence Street." "Why the hell are we going there, Sia?" "It's my dogs, fleas all over their ankles and behind their ears." "Have you considered the vet?" "No, no," said Alicia. "They need that real medicine, that herbal stuff." Their names were Kane and Oscar. Gary's from before the marriage. Black labs, always in hysterics. Alicia tolerated the dogs, only shuddered at their clumsy galloping, their narrow bodies twisting around the end tables and chairs. That morning, after wrangling them into the backyard where Kane, her least liked, gnawed an entire fallen tree branch, Alicia went upstairs to discover that she was pregnant for the second time in her life. She was 29, 30 in a week, a perfectly acceptable age to have a child. But Alicia felt dread, almost grief. She was wrapped in a white bath towel, hunched over the toilet as she broke the plastic pregnancy test in two, burying it beneath the unused tampons and wadded Kleenex. She wouldn't tell a soul, not even Gary. Especially not Gary, who'd had so much to say lately about her biological clock. They'd been married 2 years. Gary was 54, a spry, white-haired auctioneer from Nebraska who owned the largest farm and automotive equipment auction yard in Denver. He'd been interested in reaching a wider Spanish-speaking audience when he first saw Alicia at a meeting for the Univision Network. "You," he told the 26-year-old graphic designer, "have a great fucking nose." Alicia grew to call him her rancher, her vaquero, her daddy. Gary simply called her by a childhood nickname, Allie Bird. She liked him to call out with his auctioneer's tongue this name in bed. All her names, really. Alicia Monica del Toro, and later, Alicia Monica del Toro Parker. Not long after the wedding, Gary took Alicia on a weekend trip to Key West, where they chartered a speedboat called Contender and rowed out to meet the sunset across the glassy plain. With the sea breeze strangely still and their faces warmed by rum, Gary held his wife from behind. "We'd make some damn good-looking kids," he said. "You already have two dogs. What more do you need? Just give me one, Allie Bird, a son to carry on my name." "You don't need a son for that," she said. "I carry that name." Botanica del Cobre sat adjacent to Tacos Jalisco, a narrow food counter with a limited selection of carnitas and tequila. Michael insisted on stopping there before anywhere else, just a shot or two, you know, to get the night rolling. It was packed with a few Mexicano families, several Chicano rockabilly couples, and of course a smattering of Anglo newcomers, white kids in Carhartt hoodies and Red Wing shoes, the clothing of work they'd never know. "I hate 'em," Michael said, clearing salt from his bottom lip. A young bleached blonde in a crop top eyed him from the soda fountain, obvious and driven. "I'll screw 'em, but I hate 'em." "Story of your life." Alicia wasn't as irritated as Michael by the influx of Denver residents. Mostly, she imagined, because she lived among them, greeted them by name at the dog park, walked alongside their designer strollers on Saturday mornings. "You can handle it, Sia." Michael scooted a glass of Hornitos across the table. "Watching my figure." Alicia wasn't sure she believed this, but it sounded plausible. "Come on, Del Cobre is closing soon." Michael tossed back the second shot. Beneath the table, he cupped Alicia's knee, a muscle memory pat. "That's one place," he said, "that I'd be happy to see close for good." He smiled at Alicia. "For the record." It had been over a decade, she thought, since they first visited the Botanica. Alicia's father was dying of liver cancer, brought on by years of working the uranium mines outside Denver. The doctors prescribed morphine, OxyContin, fentanyl patches. Nothing masked his agony without shutting down his brain. "That's it," Alicia's abuela Lopez told her one autumn afternoon. "Your papa deserves to die with dignity of mind." She sent Alicia and Michael down Lawrence Street with a piece of paper on which she had written a list of herbs in her shaky script. When they returned to his bedside, Alicia's father held her hand and asked in an empty voice, "Were you in the garden, Stephanie?" That was the worst part, how toward the end he often confused Alicia with her mother, Stephanie Elkhorn, an Anglo woman who, when Alicia was 4, packed her purses and thrift store dresses and didn't come back. They entered the Botanica to the ringing of bells, a banana rind tied around the brass doorknob. Protection or warning? Either way, some kind of brujeria. The walls were covered in crucifixes and mirrors, rodent skulls, and santo candles. An old man wearing several orange and black necklaces lounged in a lawn chair, catching the end of some sports program on a decades-old radio. He fiddled with the antenna and waved at Michael and Alicia, motioning toward a bilingual sign on the counter. "Ask me about free cleansings for New Year. Bring 8 lilies and 1 coconut. Must wear white." Michael pulled Alicia near, speaking warmly through her hair. "For the dogs, right?" She shushed him, pressing him away with an open palm. "Excuse me," she said to the clerk. A woman in a pink frock, her back slightly curved, emerged from behind a beaded curtain. She stepped onto a wooden box standing tall at the long counter with display cases of fresh cow hearts and dried cobra skins. ¿Les puedo ayudar en algo? Alicia only